was scheduled to attend a U.S.-Italy business forum in Miami this weekend. That's been canceled. President Trump had claimed that Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni had begged for a photograph with him during the G7 summit. Meloni posted a video that that claim was completely fabricated and that Italy and I do not beg. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Penn Medicine, committed to innovation since 1751, from groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care. Penn Medicine is working to change lives. And the listeners who donate to this NPR station.
Well, that catchy tune means it's time once again for The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Brian Ritter from Nahant Marsh. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. Brian Ritter, I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to this conversation because I have followed your career and the amazing work you and your team have been engaged in at Nahant Marsh, and I'm really nosy, and I want to learn more. So thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And these are busy days, I know, so I'm grateful that you're able to take a little bit of time to be with us this morning. And we're going to get to all the important work that you're doing in our community in just a moment, but first, you know, I'm a nosy guy. Did you grow up around here?
I did. I think a sixth or eighth generation Iowan. So my I had a great grandfather three or four times removed that came to Davenport in 1845, if you can believe that. And so on my dad's side, they've been here for a long time, engaged in farming and things like that. And had a great childhood growing up in Bettendorf. My grandparents actually still had a farm, if you can believe that, on State Street in Bettendorf, and got to spend my youth, you know, out exploring streams and, you know, learning about nature the most natural way, just, you know, playing. So
I absolutely believe that the transformation of what is today Bettendorf is just almost incomprehensible.
It's unrecognizable. I mean, I actually went to out by the Betplex TBK area, and I hadn't been out there in a few years, and I did not recognize it whatsoever. So
it used to be, not that long ago, it was a great place to ride your bike, quiet roads, and you could, you know, really kind of get lost and then sneak underneath I-80 and keep riding into North Scott County. But it's a little more difficult nowadays.
It is. it's a double-edged sword. It's been, you know, having grown up in these places, little wild places that were still there, to see them lost has been, you know, a little disturbing, I guess, a little heartbreaking. You know, I know it's progress in some way, but hopefully we can do a better job of protecting some of these natural areas that we still have.
Well, I can see a couple of clues right now. You grew up around some farmland that was inside the urban area, the urban scape. When you look back on it, what were some of the clues to you that you were going to wind up making your career as a defender of natural places?
I had no idea. I mean, you know, I didn't know you could, there was careers like this. I actually, when I was late in high school, I was really good at science and math. I had a guidance counselor who said, "Oh, you should go into physical therapy. There's a huge demand for that." So, you know, I had no clue you could, you know, work in the environment, especially around here. And so I went pre-PT for a couple of years and did a job shadow and was like, man, I do not want to do this job for the rest of my life, and kind of found it in a roundabout way, you know. So I began teaching. I finished a master's actually in public health. Began teaching at the community college level, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. started working on a second master's in biology. And got fortunate enough that at the time Nahant was really struggling. There was no education program. It had kind of fallen apart.
Yeah.
They approached Muscatine Community College, or EICC,
yeah,
to form this partnership to develop this education program. And my boss at the time said, hey, I think you'd really love this. Take a stab at it. And,
wow.
And, you know, here I am almost 20 years later. I thought I would stay for 2 or 3 years and get something going. But I really fell in love with the place. And, you know, I feel very fortunate that I've had this opportunity to kind of help shape Nahant Marsh and, you know, build something much better for the community.
So I can see this tie-in between public health and biology, but what was your undergraduate major?
It ended up being psychology with a minor in biology. Oh, you know, I was fantastic. Taking all these classes preparing. And, you know, looking back, all of that stuff was so valuable for me becoming, you know, who I have become in terms of learning about not only the natural world, but kind of bigger part of it is how to deal with people, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. that is so much of my job now, that not just the psychology part, but, you know, the public health and all those things that go with it, grant writing, you know, when you're in college, you think, well, I'm never going to need history or math, but it all, you know, my role, it all plays.
Yeah.
It all comes into play. Yeah.
We're going to get into that too. And also this tension, right? Because I think it's an old joke. National parks would be great if we just didn't allow people in them, but it kind of defeats the purpose, right?
Right.
So you need to balance all these things. And, and so that's really cool that you were into psychology as well as biology and everything else. That's pretty nifty. So I just want to make sure we're not missing any pieces on this cool trajectory. So Bettendorf High, and then off to undergrad and graduate schools.
Yeah,
Where did you do that?
So I went to St. Ambrose for my undergrad, went to Western Illinois for my master's. Yeah. And then, you know, took classes here and there at University of Iowa, Iowa State. And
Yeah.
So it's been a real fun. My problem is, I think, like I'm curious about everything. Like,
that's not a problem, Brian.
Yeah, no. I mean, I could have majored in history or philosophy.
Yeah.
I mean, I love it all. And I was so intrigued, especially when I got to college, like just learning all these, you know, different theories and, you know, but like I said, I think it's been a benefit to my career because it is, you know, we touch on a lot of those things at Nahant Marsh.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, and I think personally, you can't study enough history.
Oh, absolutely.
Because virtually every mistake we see being made today has been made.
Right.
Most of them have been made already.
Absolutely.
And if we just learn to watch those warning signs instead of driving off the cliff with the flashing red lights all over the dashboard, I think we'd be better off. So, all right. Now, this is nice homegrown education, Bettendorf, Ambrose, Western, Iowa, Iowa State. I love all that. And so you were teaching at Muscatine when the call came?
Yeah, Muscatine Community College. I was teaching some biology, environmental science, a few health classes. And, you know, I actually still teach some college classes. When I moved up to Nahant, I took this old conservation program with me. And so, you know, I still teach, you know, 1 to 3 classes every semester. And it's a real joy because, you know, it forces me to keep my skills up, you know, in turn, teaching is really an art form. And, but I really love interacting with that age group. It just, you know, I learned so much from my students and vice versa. So it's kind of kept me young in a sense.
Well, it's succeeding wonderfully. So well done. Let's talk now a little bit about Nahant and maybe start with the history of before you came into the picture. How did this remarkable resource come about?
Well, so I'm going to go back about 1,000 years. So,
well, this is public radio, I prefer to go back 10,000 years.
Yeah, well, we can.
1,000's great.
Yeah, but you know, Nahant was a side channel of the Mississippi River, and the land that, you know, our building is on, and that, you know, some of our trails are on, that was an island in the river, and the river Mississippi's always sort of changing its course, finding a better path that left behind. And by the time Euro-American settlement occurred, Nahant was really an oxbow lake. And so still connected to the river on one end. And when the river would flood, it would back in there. And incredible history, because one of the first settlements in the county was there. It was called Rockingham. Mm-hmm. That was a town that was thriving. And from about 1833 to about 1847, it was really rivaling Davenport. It was would have been the county seat, but ended up losing. And then what really did Rockingham in was the fact that there was a major flood in 1844. And, you know, that land that the town occupied became an island again. And most folks said, well, we're not going to deal with this. And they moved on either to Davenport or over to here to Rock Island. And then fast forward, kind of empty space for a while. And then 1880s, the railroad came through and a little town called Nahant appeared. And that thrived for a while. There was ice harvesting, so really large ice houses there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, there was a steamboat stop. There was a rail yard. And by the 1920s, it became a rather sort of seedy place. It was John Looney. His main madam was a woman named Helen Van Dale. And she had some of her largest brothels there at Nahant. And so there was all that fascinating sort of criminal history. 1969, the area became a gun club. And for about 30 years, they shot trap and skeet over the marsh. And that created a real problem in that there was lead contamination. And our friend Kathy Wine really spearheaded...
River Action
really spearheaded a grassroots effort to get the place cleaned up. And ultimately the EPA came in, said, this is in bad enough shape. We're calling it a Superfund site. They dredged out about 140 tons of lead out of the marsh.
Wow.
But afterwards they said, this is in good enough shape, should be maintained for education and as a nature preserve. And so that started in the year 2000. We're in year 26 and we've been sort of growing ever since.
That's an amazing story. That's so much more than I had ever known.
Yeah.
Now, I did look up, Nahant is a place name in New England. So they were trying to think, you know, like New Boston or something like that, real classy. So, but
it's curious. And we've tried to dig into that. So, Nahant is an Algonquin Indian word. They don't say it right out there. They call it Nahant. We say Nahant, but it's kind of like Milan and Milan, you know. But so Nahant is an Algonquin Indian word that means land between the waters, which is really fitting for us. And it out there, it's a saltwater marsh around it. And so we're not sure if, you know, those settlers moving across from Boston area it reminded them of that place, or if the local, because the Sauk and Meskwaki speak a dialect of Algonquin, and so we're not sure if it was the native folks that had been here. We may never know, but fascinating name and history.
I was also intrigued to learn about the Rockingham being a competitor to Davenport for the, because right about the same time, there was a big fight going on in Rock Island County. And I don't know if you know this story, but I owe it to Judge Vandewiele, who shared this with me, Mark Vandewiele, great local historian. So you had it easy. A flood told you this is not a good place for a county seat. In the other side of the river, it was a close call between Rock Island and Hampton, because those are the towns at either end of the rapids.
Sure.
So that's where a lot of the wealth was. The pilots, you know, would be based in one or the other. So they were going to have a big vote. And Colonel George Davenport was going to oversee the vote. And the way the story goes, they were downtown Rock Island because there was already some infrastructure there. And I think President Tyler had given them some land for a courthouse. And the Hampton boys came in loaded for bear and with a few beers under their belts. And they were going to make sure that the vote went their way. And then all of a sudden, and never let the facts get in the way of a good story. But Davenport signaled to the troops over on Fort Armstrong on the island that you could come over and vote now. And the Hampton guys thought, oh, the fix is in. So they stole the ballot box and rode off. And Davenport even arranged to have a couple of sheriff's deputies fire guns in the air, to, you know, as if they're chasing them back to Hampton. But they think, we've done it. We've got the ballot. We've got the vote. Well, no sooner are they out of sight and earshot when Colonel Davenport says, well, what do you know? Here's the real ballot box. And he put that out on the table, and Rock Island won unanimously.
Oh, my gosh.
Not a single vote for Hampton. But, you know, that's the way the story goes.
Yeah.
A flood would have been easier.
Yeah. Well, there were similar shenanigans that, you know, so there were actually three elections that occurred for county seat. And the first one, Davenport won, but there was evidence that they went to Dubuque, got a bunch of lead miners drunk, brought them down and swore them in as citizens to vote. And then Rockingham did the same thing. The second election, they went to Cedar County and got a bunch of woodcutters drunk. And so finally the third one, Davenport won outright. But yeah, talk about stolen elections. We won't go there, but
those are the stories that I love. Yeah. All right. So, but you also talked about the ever shifting Mississippi. And, that's something that I don't think we pay enough attention to, that there's nothing that says, I mean, until the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration that says this is the way the river has to be.
Yeah.
It has moved around a lot. And we see that as still to some degree now, but not quite.
We've kind of hemmed in the river, you know, with the levees and locks and dams and things like that. And of course, we've built infrastructure, you know, roads, towns, railroads, and farms all
quarries,
along.
And so factories.
Yeah. So we try to keep the river where it is, but the river is going to do what the river's going to do.
Yeah.
And
well, you do a great job telling the environmental story, and we're going to dive into that. But has anybody captured that wonderful, colorful, loony-esque human history of the place?
Just a little bit. I mean, I've been trying to dig through the history, and I've created a little presentation. And eventually, I want to, you know, maybe write a book about the area, because there was so much fascinating history. And, you know, between not only those towns, but there was a large Hispanic settlement, Mexican settlement called Cook's Point right near there. There was also evidence of a large African-American community there that was working on the railroad and working in the ice houses at the time. Even stories from the, you know, 19-teens and 1920s of Greek encampments that were sometimes attacked by the locals and the Roma or the traveling community that would be in and out of that area. So really fascinating human history. And then, you know, going back even further, you know, there's evidence that people were using that area. There was Clovis points found on the bluff that are 10 to 12,000 years old above Nahant. And at Nahant itself, you know, we've done some archaeological exploration and found things like beads made out of bird bones that were 700 or 800 years old and flint knap. And so certainly humans have been in the area for a really, really long time.
And, and then it's interesting that the Sauk and Meskwaki people have such a profound shaping effect on who we are today, but they were really only here for about 100 years. They got pushed along with other Algonquian peoples by the Europeans coming in New England, and they were here for a while, and then Illinois becomes a state and basically kicks everybody out, and so it's, well, I hope you write that book, Brian.
It's I love history, one of my many passions, and it's been incredible to dig up, you know, these past stories. And there's still some older folks that, you know, they grew up there, and we've been able to capture their stories.
You also mentioned a chapter in the story about the sporting clubs. And for a long time, everyone thought, well, they're great because they're protecting the environment, but they're, when they're shooting, they're leaving tons, as you said, so many tons of lead behind. Are those kinds of clubs getting better? I know there's one for pheasants and for ducks and for all kinds. Are they getting better about minding the spaces that are in their custody?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we are actually working with Ducks Unlimited currently to do a design for a 60-acre parcel that we're going to be converting into wetlands. It's been farm fields for 100 years. And so, you know, I've been really impressed with groups like Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever. Of course, you know, they started as sort of hunting promoting groups, but they have realized, I would say this shift has happened probably in the last 20 years, that you cannot have ducks and pheasants and things like that without habitat. And so that's been their real focus, is creating habitat. And, you know, the secondary sort of thing is, yeah, go and hunt them for sport or something. But and, you know, Nahant, I specifically, you know, we had this sort of shooting club there for mm-hmm. many years, mm-hmm. but I would say the silver lining or maybe the lead lining behind them being there was that had they not been there, that place almost definitely would have been filled in. The city dump was expanding. They mm-hmm. ran out of space, and the city of Davenport actually approached the gun club in the late 60s and said, hey, we'll fill this in with trash, but you know, then it won't flood anymore. And the gun club said, no, we don't want that. And so, you know,
yeah,
the positive thing, had sure. the gun club not been there, the marsh probably would not exist today.
So, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And the things that we have done with our refuse, and that's why, you know, despite what's going on in DC, you really got to lean into science.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
There's a whole party that set itself up against science, but we need to be thinking about that because of decisions like that. I mean, just imagine if they had gone ahead and put the landfill there based on their understanding of, you know, economics at the time.
Yeah.
But no, that hasn't happened. What is the total acreage of Nahant Marsh?
So we currently own 382 acres. We're actively negotiating for a few parcels. I would say the total breadth of Nahant, you know, the wetlands itself and, you know, undeveloped land is closer to about 700 acres. So, you know, that is kind of a goal of mine, you know, before I die or retire is maybe whether we have landowners putting their land in conservation easements or we own the land outright. But, you know, Nahant, when Interstate 280 was built, it essentially cut Nahant in half.
Right.
And so we really own most of the upper half that is undeveloped now. It's that lower half that I would still like to see some more permanent protection on. It's
by
still
upper and lower, you mean river, the downriver part?
Yeah, okay, the downriver side. Okay, yeah, okay. And so we're Nahant. The marsh is still connected. There's a there's a large culvert under 280, but it's another thing. Longer in the future, I'd love to see them move 280, but I don't think that's going to happen. So.
Well, but I mean, it is important to connect these parcels of ecosystems. And we see that in Rock Island County, too, where we, you know, we just got this amazing Amoa Forest Preserve, which is two large chunks.
Right.
And they're not really connected. And there's a road going right down the middle. Now, for some turtle species, that might as well be the Grand Canyon.
Exactly.
And we need them to be able to interact with each other so that they can keep their populations healthy.
And I really would love to see that. And there's some groups that are sort of loosely working on that in the Quad Cities, but creating corridors mm-hmm. to connect, you know, we've got these wonderful preserves all around the area, but they're almost islands right now.
And we're going to connect those. We're going to mm-hmm. keep connecting our listeners with this great story because my guest this week on The Conversation on WBIK is Brian Ritter from the Nahant Marsh. We will be shortly coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, which means we get a chance to tell you that the forecast for today is just what you're seeing. Sunny skies with a high near 81 degrees. That is on Saturday, I should say. And we want you to stick around because The Conversation on WVIK will be back in just a moment. We'll continue to learn more about Nahant Marsh and the importance of wetlands in our community. Please, friends, stay tuned.
WVIK comes from Golder Care Solutions, offering advice about preserving assets, planning for the nursing home, and navigating Medicaid. Golder Care Solutions has been serving the Quad Cities since 2008. More information is at goldercare.com. And support for WVIK comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org. And support for WVIK also comes from the Levitt Amp Galva Music Series, offering family-friendly concerts in Wiley Park, Galva, Illinois, on Sundays at 6 p.m. Open to the public. A full list of performers is available at levittamp.org/galva.
My name is John B. Donovan from Dubuque, Iowa, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Hey, welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK. And a chat with this week's guest, Brian Ritter from Nahant Marsh. Brian, thank you so much for spending your lovely morning here with us in the studios. But it's hard for me to believe, as you mentioned, that Nahant Marsh is really a quarter of a century old, yeah. Right? Because you have done so much in terms of the preservation, but also the education. We haven't gotten to that too much yet. So at what point in the history of the marsh and your interaction, hiring an educator, a college prof was probably a good move. But when did that pivot start to lean really heavily into community education?
Well, so, you know, Nahant, when we were founded in the year 2000, that really was sort of a mission, was to provide education. In those first couple years, Nahant had a partnership with the Putnam Museum, and the Putnam was providing a naturalist and, you know, was doing educational programming for, you know, a couple thousand, mostly school kids every year, and connecting folks. Well, the Putnam you know, sort of refocused. They pulled out of the marsh, and for about 2 years, there was really nothing there. There was some volunteers that were kind of keeping the thing going. And so when we formed this partnership with EICC, that was the goal, to try to build a robust ed program for people of all ages. And so we, you know, that first year that I was there, that was 2007, we served maybe 1,800 people with our ed program. Last year, we served about 25,000 people with our ed program. And about half of those are K through 12 students. Yeah. And that is really, you know, that's been a priority of mine and a priority of the board. As I mentioned, with my personal history, I got to just spend time in nature, just the most natural way. And so many kids nowadays do not have that opportunity. And, you know, if people don't know it, they're not going to love it. And if they don't love it, they're not going to work and vote to protect places like Nahant. And so I think that that is so critically important, is to get people connected. And I know there's always this balance of, do we put people in nature preserves? Do we keep people out? Well, I think there's definitely an importance of getting people connected with nature and knowing about the value of the Mississippi River and the wetlands that are part of that. And so, our education program has been a fantastic thing to see grow. And that's that I had a small part in that. I've got some really fantastic staff that, just super creative and love to have fun, but love to get out there and connect folks with it. And so, you know, we get all the K through 12 field trips that come through in the spring and the fall, especially, but then we have day camps that go on all summer. So we're for kids of all ages. We have 15 different day camps. Some of them are week long. Some of them are a couple days. But that really allows those kids to get immersed in the marsh and, you know, natural history and all that other fun stuff. We also do a monthly homeschool program. So it's been super cool to see. We've had kids that have actually grown up through our homeschool program that, you know, started coming there when I was still doing the classes, you know, 15 years ago, and now are going to college for this. And so that's been neat to hopefully inspire the next generation.
I can't be the only grandparent listening right now who's thinking, I got to find more about these classes and camps. Where could I go to find out all this information?
NahantMarsh.org. That's the best landing spot. We have social media, of course, too, Facebook and all that. But yeah, we have a ton of programs. And so most of our camps are filling up, but we've still got a few spots.
Yeah. I feel very fortunate. My parents were, and this is for the late 60s and early 70s, they really wanted us out there getting our hands dirty, muddy, and learning about stuff. But you're right. It's harder for parents to provide those opportunities today. So to the fact that Nahant can do this for our community, that's just phenomenal. So that's great. Yeah. 25,000, that's amazing.
Yeah. And so then, you know, the other part of it is we have all these really cool education programs. So we're part of a partnership with Iowa State University. We do a master conservationist program. It's kind of similar to Master Gardeners, but adult ed focus. So we get, you know, people out to different natural areas around the community, let them, you know, learn and become more engaged in the natural world. We do a thing every the first Friday of every month called Breakfast Nature Club. So we have a different, expert come in and talk about a different environmental theme, provide a light breakfast. And so that's really kind of get a lot of older folks that come to that and just a whole bunch of other neat stuff that, that happens there.
Well, and I know this about you, Brian and Nahant, is that you guys don't simply focus on those several hundred acres. You really partner with a lot of other groups. And I
we
think
do.
There's something coming up called Bio Blitz. Could you
yes.
tell us about that?
Yeah. So, several years ago, we formed this group called BICAN. BICAN is the Bi-State Conservation Action Network. And the whole purpose of BICAN is to get other conservationists and volunteers and people of interest together to work towards a common cause. And so it started as sort of a networking group, but we've evolved into doing actual stuff. And so this weekend, and we've been doing these for several years, about every other year, we do what's called a BioBlitz. And the BioBlitz, the purpose is to get experts together and go to a natural area and just try to identify as much stuff as we can, mm-hmm. plants, mm-hmm. insects, you know, mammals, birds, bats, you name it. And that way, we have sort of a baseline. We know that, okay, this year, 2026, we had 800 plus species at this location. And the hope is that if we go back in 50 years, we'll still have at least that many plants and animals there. It's a way to measure biodiversity.
Yeah.
And so this year, it's really exciting. We're going to a place called the Wapsie River Environmental Education Center, which is out near Dixon, Iowa. And then across the river from that is a really fantastic county park called Sherman Park. We know that these places are loaded with both rare and common species.
Mm-hmm.
But people haven't been there to really document that in a long time. And so that's the goal. And the fun part is my nerd side. I love going out and identifying plants and birds. But it's also a way for the community to come out and sort of learn about these really neat places and these really neat plants and animals that are living in them.
I know the environmental studies folks at Augustana love it when they occur during a school year so they can take scads of students out. But did I read that it goes overnight too so you can be like listening for bats and things like that?
Yeah. So we start, this upcoming weekend, so Friday and Saturday, starts at 2 p.m. on Friday, goes till 2 p.m. on Saturday. And so we literally have people that are out, you know, surveying for owls, they set up these sheets and with lights to attract moths and that, you know, all that stuff has to happen at night. So there is literally people that are going to be up for that whole 24 hours.
Sure.
Not me. I need my rest. But, it is really a fun thing. Like I said, we've done several natural areas around the Quad Cities. And that's kind of our goal, to get to all these great natural places and really document so we have a good baseline of what is here in the Quad Cities.
Well, and I'm grateful for all of the that have been done and the ones that keep going on. I get to serve on the Rock Island County Forest Reserve Commission, mm-hmm. and I got to tell you, probably the most rewarding aspect of that gig is when we identify in the forest preserves a species that was either gone for decades or is very endangered. So like the rusty patch bumblebee, the American bumblebee. There's even a kind of a pheasant that, or quail, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. quail. It's not so much that it's uncommon, it just hasn't been seen in Rock Island County for generations.
Right. Bobwhite quail.
Yeah. And so great people like Mike Peterson working very diligently to methodically support the native ecosystem.
Yes.
And that's something I'd like to talk with you a little bit more about after the break. But here we are. We're telling these great stories about environmental wins in the Quad Cities. But stories are what we're all about here at WVIK, which means it's that time once again for us to step aside and let a master storyteller step in, Dr. Roald Tweet and Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. As the winds of change blew down the Mississippi River and through the halls of higher learning in the 1960s, more than a few classrooms around Rock Island began teaching students to be lemons. English teachers whose lives had been cocooned by commas and semicolons were reborn as butterflies. Out went the red pencils, worksheets, and nearly all the 359 writing mistakes which needed correcting. The winds of change were crying, "Be spontaneous, be creative, baby, just be yourselves." English teachers found that a bit hard, but with the help of new writing texts such as "It's Mine and I'll Write It That Way," they gave it their best shot. Out went outlines, rows of chairs, and carefully reasoned arguments for or against admitting Red China to the United Nations. In came the lemon. I don't know why the lemon beat out the apple, pear, or cantaloupe, but it did. Here's how it worked. Writing students were asked to bring pillows and journals to class and sit in a circle on the floor around the room. The teacher would dim the lights. The lemon sat on a low stool in the center of the circle, illuminated by a flashlight. Students were invited to stare at the lemon until they could feel its yellowness, its juice, its tart taste, and then begin to write on what it was like to be a lemon. I am a plump, round lemon. For some of them, it didn't work. They just remained Barb Cooper from Chicago or Peter Zimmer from Moline, but many became perfect lemons and blinked and were surprised when the lights came back on. This sudden release of creative juices seemed to have had little permanent effect. Most English teachers have repented and returned to commas. Former lemons are now some of Rock Island area's stiffest and most respected lawyers, bankers, and doctors. Only rarely in a waiting room or on a desk next to a nameplate will you see a single bright yellow lemon.
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And while we may no longer have Dr. Tweet with us in person, we have him in spirit and this wonderful legacy of storytelling, which you help support, friends. When you go to WVIK.org and hit that magical red donate button, you help protect this station from the vicissitudes of federal funding and brainless policy and keep it around so we can have a place for Rock Island Lines and something you can tune into week in and week out. And I'm glad you're tuned in right now, because my guest is Brian Ritter from Nahant Marsh, which I want to remind you, you can learn more about it at nahantmarsh.org. But we're talking a little bit about these preservation, conservation, species restoration things. And one thing that I think gets lost often in a lot of the public discourse is that doesn't just happen. You know, we've had a big conversation in town about this parcel of land that used to be a landfill. It's not technically Milan Bottoms. That's a little further downstream, but it gets called that. And some people say just leave it alone. But if you do, then you're really hamstringing what the magic that could happen. So, I mean, the city is trying to work on ways to create funding to do the restoration work. I think they have talked with you. They've talked to us at the Forest Reserve Commission. And hopefully they'll continue that sort of thoughtful approach. But talk about what it takes to invest in native species restoration.
Yeah. So, you know, the issue is in Iowa and Illinois, Iowa is the most biologically altered state in the United States. Illinois is second. Mm. And these little bits of nature that we have left, you know, that the thought was in the 50s and 60s when they were set up as preserves or whatever, that just leave your hands off, it'll take care of itself. Well, we have so many pressures, invasive species, native species decline,
climate change,
you name it, that if we don't take an active management approach for some of these areas, they will eventually die a slow death. Mm-hmm. You know, they're either getting choked by those invasives or species are just inbreeding and declining over time. And so I am very much a proponent of active management. And so Nahant has invested a lot of money to make sure that we're restoring parcels in the proper way, that we're applying active management and flexible management tools. So all of our staff are wildland firefighters. We set the place on fire once in a while, and that's it's necessary. And fire was a key component that was here for thousands of years. And so we spend a lot of time and money harvesting seeds and replanting those native seeds in other areas. And so we're at this stage, this very strange stage in humanity that our nature has become somewhat dependent on us for its survival. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope we can get to a place somewhere down the road where it's not so dependent on humans, that we can create large enough preserves and those corridors between and things like that. And you know, and on the Milan Bottoms note, you know, I very much view Nahant as part of a much bigger system that includes the Milan Bottoms, it includes Credit Island, it includes the confluence of the Rock and the Mississippi River. And it's incredible. I was looking at, you know, the amount of sort of natural spaces just between Nahant and Milan Bottoms, mm-hmm, and those others. Mm-hmm. And there's about 6,000 acres of sort of wetland and forest habitat just in that neck of the woods. I mean, that is our largest sort of natural area in the Quad Cities. And it's so valuable for wildlife, for clean water, for flood mitigation, all these other things. So I am hopeful that the city is going to move in the right direction and try to find a good balance to protect the majority of that land.
And that's the rub, right?
Yeah,
so to fund 550 acres of active management, you need to have some retail activity on 9 acres.
Yeah.
And some people don't want to see that, but the city, you know, we're not like Bettendorf. We can't plow over hundreds of acres of farmland to build a youth athletic thing. Rock Island is cash strapped. I mean, so it needs, if it wants to do something aspirational like this, it's got to find the money to do it.
Yeah. Right? And, you know, I sympathize with Rock Island. You know, unfortunately, Rock Island's gone through tough times.
Yep.
You know, you've seen a decline in population. You've mm-hmm. seen businesses leave. And mm-hmm. so, I'm hopeful that construction will be built in a way that is not going to impact the species that are there,
right,
and that the majority of it can be set aside, protected. And then, you know, and then as a bigger picture is like, we've got this incredible natural resource, the Milan Bottoms, Nahant, all these others.
Yeah.
How do we start sort of co-marketing that as a ecotourism,
exactly,
you know, destination and find some incentive for protecting it? You know,
I'm with you. Listen, I'm an optimist, but we have to hold their feet to the fire, all right? Because the plans they've been talking about, they have made changes to mitigate the impact. And then I think I want to dwell on that fire thing that a lot of people don't quite get. Evolution is just such genius. And so there are a lot of these native species that evolved so that their seed husks were fire resistant.
Right.
And so you burn a place, you get rid of a lot of the invasive flora and you pave the way for the native flora to come back and flourish.
Right. And, you know, so I look at any patch of woods that we have in our area and it probably looks nothing like what our earliest settlers found here. The early settlement accounts, especially in Iowa, said that you could drive a horse and a carriage through our woods without hitting a tree. Our woods were incredibly open, and they were open because of frequent fire.
Mm.
And so when you don't have fire in our woods, our prairies, and even to some degree in our wetlands, species get lost and they're unhealthy. It's a sick woods, a really mm-hmm. thick woods mm-hmm. is a sick woods, I would say.
Yeah.
And we see this, we've seen this abundance of like ticks, the presence of ticks increasing in our area. The best way to manage for tick populations is fire.
Hmm.
And so research bears that out time and again. And so, but it's incredible, you know, people think, oh, you're destroying this with fire. How resilient and how well these natural areas respond to fire. We've burned places and suddenly we see species returning that we haven't seen in years. And it's just, they were waiting for those right conditions.
Yeah. That was exactly, I think, what happened with Mike Peterson and Illiniwek is they did some burns. I got to actually help out. Well, not help. I stayed out of the way. But after that is when we started to see this rusty patch bumblebee come back. And it's a magical thing. But you're right. The goal would be a time when we don't have to be as actively involved. You've told us so many interesting things. What are some fun things that you're looking forward to at Nahant Marsh in the months ahead that we might want to go to nahantmarsh.org and find out more about?
Yeah, so upcoming, you know, I mentioned the day camps that are going on, and there's still spaces for the young ones. But every fall, we do two really cool events. In September, we do what's called our Monarch Party. And so we actually have, you know, last year we had about 800 people come to our Monarch Party. And this is really a celebration of monarchs and pollinators in general. We have different vendors, activities for kids. And we actually catch monarchs and tag them so that we can, and so families can come and tag a monarch and hopefully track that monarch all the way to Mexico if they're lucky. And so, and then we do our annual Fall Fest, which is just kind of a general celebration of the marsh, and that's in early October. So a lot of great stuff coming up soon.
Now, what are things that we can do, those of us who are not biologists, who may have full-time gigs and other pursuits, but how can we lend our assistance and support and be engaged with Nahant Marsh?
Yeah, so time, treasure, and talent is what, you know, everybody always says. But, you know, there's great ways to get involved. We last year we saw about 300 volunteers help us. We always need volunteers, and whether that's, you know, helping us harvest seed, pull invasive species, or if you want to help behind the scenes, you know, help us plan events, things like that. We always need that. Donations, go to nahantmarsh.org, and we always...
Oh, you have one of those bright red donate buttons too, right?
Yes, of course. Donate to VIK and Nahant
there
Marsh.
You go.
You know, also, you know, just doing stuff in your own backyard. What's incredible here in the United States, we have about 45 million acres of lawn. And if everybody just planted 5% or 10% of their backyard with some native wildflower species or plant an oak tree, suddenly we'd have about 4 million new acres of habitat for wildlife.
Well, you got one in our backyard.
Awesome.
We have what the city was famous for promoting, rain gardens. Got a couple of different types of milkweed and all kinds of stuff back there. But anything we can do along those lines. Now, in addition to being a steward and a custodian of this valuable resource, you had mentioned to me earlier that you've got a little farm yourself. Tell me about that.
I do, yeah. So I just live on the bluff above Nahant. I've got a really short commute to work, but I've got about we've got about 6 acres there, and we've got a few goats and chickens and a small orchard and you know, greenhouse and stuff like that. So we used to sell some of our produce and things, but really now we're just growing our own food and just trying to manage the land the best we can. My first year that we moved in there, I was kicking around in the dirt, and I found what was turned out to be a hammer stone. And I took it to an archaeologist. He said, well, that's over 2,000 years old. So got to thinking, you know, people have been living on my land at least for 2,000 years. And it's my duty to kind of steward that land, hopefully for another few generations.
That is so cool. What are the orchards, if I can be so nosy?
Oh, apples. And I've got a lot of like native stuff. So I planted pawpaws, if you've ever had pawpaws, and persimmons and hazelnuts and walnuts, and then of course peaches, cherries, things like that. Yeah.
Wonderful. Now I understand these goats have to earn their keep with
they
you.
They do. Yeah. So I rent, we'll rent these goats occasionally. So for instance, like Dear Wyman House in Moline has rented them before, and I'll take them to Nahant to do work and things like that. But really that's one of those tools. So, you know, in our area, we would have had elk and bison that would have filled that niche. Those are gone now. So we're trying to sort of mimic nature to the best we can. And goats are a really great way to clear some of those woody invasives that are coming in.
Oh, Brian, I've been having a ball, but I've got to keep being nosy. Do you ever get any spare time for reading? If so, what are you reading lately?
Yeah. I most recently reread a book that I've read a couple times in the past. It was called A Country So Full of Game, and it was written by a professor at Iowa State named James Dinsmore. And it really, it chronicles the history of wildlife in Iowa, and really, sadly, it chronicles the kind of the disappearance. And I'm just getting ready to start reading. His son wrote a follow-up to that. So this book was written in the late 80s, early 90s. His son just wrote a follow-up to kind of show, okay, where is life at now in Iowa?
So yeah.
I really like that sort of local natural history. I also recently reread a Sand County Almanac.
Yeah.
If you know, that's of course kind of the Bible for us conservationists.
Aldo Leopold.
Yeah.
And that I know there's a local award. I think that named for him. Are you part of that?
Well, so we do an award called the Oberholzer Awards.
That's right.
Yeah,
okay.
And Oberholzer is a whole other story we don't have time for, but he was really the most famous conservationist from Davenport. He saved the boundary waters in northern Minnesota, southern Canada, and he's kind of a god up there, but long forgotten around here. So we wanted to create this awards in his honor, you know, and bring his memory and his legacy back.
Well, it just means you have to come back on sometimes.
That's right.
Tell me more stories about stuff like that.
I would love
What are some other things that occupy you in the summer? I love tips on summer in the Quad Cities. There's so many great concerts to go to. What are things that you like to do in the summer?
Well, so I just had shoulder surgery. Normally, I would be biking. I love mountain biking, and we've got fantastic at Lineawick and Sunderbrook Park in Davenport.
But play on that a little bit more. Are you active with Friends of Off-Road Cycling?
I am not currently, but I am part of several others. So I just did Big Sand Mound Field Day. So down in Muscatine County, I'm part of this advisory council for this wonderful preserve called Big Sand Mound. I'm very active at a place called Fairmount Cemetery. There's this beautiful remnant prairie there. And so we started a Friends of Fairmount Cemetery and work to protect that incredible little remnant prairie that's there.
Yeah. Well, and I love to put in a plug. I'm not a member of FORC, as it's called, but they have been such critical allies at Illiniwek in creating a system whereby, slow hikers like me can coexist with mountain bikers and everybody has a great day.
They're fantastic. Yeah they've done great work around the Quad Cities.
All right. Now I've picked you on some activities to do, books, anything else you want to share that has been catching your fancy lately?
Well, I mean, really just getting outdoors. I love exploring new natural areas. I've been hiking around West Lake the last couple weeks just to get my steps in the morning. It's incredible what's there. West Lake did a great new recent restoration project. And Sunderbrook Park is fantastic. But I can't stress enough, if folks, you know, get out to the Wapsie Center this weekend.
And help with the BioBlitz. Oh, man, I knew this was going to happen. It just went by so fast.
It did.
But I want to thank my guest, Brian Ritter from Nahant Marsh. You are welcome here anytime, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And for the rest of us, please keep in mind that you can catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK. Saturday mornings live at 10 o'clock. And that's just before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8 right after Fresh Air. You can also find recent episodes at WVIK.org and looking for us under the podcast tab. Well, from the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for the conversation on WVIK when our guest will be Francis Williams from Mercado on Fifth. I hope you'll tune in and join us. Until then, get out and enjoy this lovely June here in the Quad Cities. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Thank you to these listeners whose recent gifts help sustain local news, music, and public radio service on WVIK. Josh Baker and John and Sonia Hurdy. We're grateful for your support of WVIK.
I'm Julianne Tung from Davenport, Iowa, and WVIK is my NPR station.
With national and international news at the top of every hour and local news throughout your day,
We're WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM, K240DZ Dubuque, WVIK, Quad Cities NPR.